The following is a rebroadcast from March of 2011.
Voy a cantar un corrido, me duele mi corazón.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. You just heard right there a piece of a corrido, a Mexican ballad, a story song. We're going to be talking about that in the first half of the program. And exploring the question, does art that depicts violence generate more violence? That's a question that Professor John McDowell takes up in his book on corridos. It's called Poetry and Violence, the Ballad Tradition of Mexico's Costa Chica. We'll be hearing some excerpts from some corridos. It's a question that touches on contemporary developments, such as gangsta rap and schoolyard shootings. Also, the big problem of drug trafficking in Mexico, and some corridos, a whole subgenre called narco corridos. That's just one of the areas that John McDowell studies, and he's chair of the Department of Folklore and Ethnomusicology at Indiana University. Maybe a starting point, I'd like to ask folklorists what folklore is. People have a vague idea, and I think it's an important question. First of all, welcome to the program, Professor.
Oh, thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Folklore, a brief thumbnail definition.
Uh-huh. Well, it's a kind of an elusive term, but the way I like to get at it is to talk about it as the art of the people or expressive culture in everyday life. And the basic idea is that human beings are very creative by nature, and even in our everyday lives, we find ways to express ourselves creatively. And folklorists are interested in those moments of creative expression, drawing on tradition, but always reshaping tradition in the process.
And what areas have you explored? I know there's been a diverse areas that you've explored.
Yes, this is true. I have two major research areas that have kept me puzzled and energized, and they've kept me going all these years. And one of them, as you have already mentioned, is the ballad tradition of the Mexican people. A fascinating tradition. Maybe we'll talk a little more about that here. And then the other big involvement I have is down in the Andes region of South America, where I've spent quite a bit of time living in indigenous communities and working with the traditions mostly of Quechua-speaking people, but also in some cases of more local indigenous languages.
So if you're pursuing an interest like the corrido, the Mexican ballad, how do you go about this? You just go out into the countryside to start talking to people?
Well, basically, you look for people who know something about the corridos. And the thing is, when I've been down in Mexico working on this topic, it's kind of a wonderful thing because Mexicans themselves are very proud of the corrido. They love corridos. Well, I would say most Mexican people love corridos. There are some people who worry about the problems of violence and so forth. But typically, they're proud of it. They cherish the tradition. And when somebody comes from another country, especially from the big bully to the north, and shows an interest in something that they themselves value, people are very happy to find the composers and the performers. And that's really what the work is about, finding those people, letting them know that I'm an educator. There's a great deal of respect for education in Mexico. If people know that you're a teacher, right away they look up to you. They think that you're a good person. And I've just had a wonderful time and also a very instructive time chasing the ballads down in Mexico.
So tell me about this form. My understanding is that the corrido, the Mexican ballad, often deals with violence.
That's true. I mean, the corridos, they can really cover quite a bit of ground. In some areas of Mexico, they love the corridos about horse races. And the typical situation is that the rich folks have a horse and they're sure they're going to win the race, but the poor folks come with some horse that might not look very promising, and you know what's going to happen. The poor folks horse is going to win the race. There are also quite a few corridos historically that have been about natural disasters, and also accidental things like train wrecks and so forth. But I would say that the great majority of corridos have to do with situations of mortal danger. Mm. And the majority of that would be people basically trying to do harm to other people. So violence is at the core of the corrido's scope of interest.
Let's hear an excerpt from a corrido. Let's hear a corrido called, or at least a part piece of it, called Sidonio. What can you tell us about this as we go in? I'm putting you on the spot here.
No, I love it. This is my stuff. Sidonio's probably my favorite corrido. I've collected over 300 of them. It's a beautiful song. It's rustic. It's rough, but it's just got a kind of a power to it. Maybe it'll come through in the excerpt. And the great thing about this is a very local corrido. This is in a small town called Cruz Grande, which is down the coast in the state of Guerrero in Mexico, down from Acapulco, down the Pacific coast a ways. And it's just a very local song about a feud that was happening in this zone. And the great thing about the corrido here and often is it doesn't really tell the story in the way that a journalist would, but rather it picks out certain very emblematic moments and it dramatizes those moments. And that's what happens in this corrido.
Let's hear an excerpt from a corrido, or a Mexican ballad, called Sidonio. There's an excerpt from a Mexican ballad or corrido. What usually are people composing this, singing this, trying to express?
Well, in this case, Sidonio, and it's not too different in many of these corridos. This is about a particular episode that happened. In this case, in this area around Cruz Grande, there was a disagreement between a couple of extended families. And this involved some exchange of violence between the two sides, where one side would be trying to do harm to the other side. And the song is kind of interesting because what one of the sides did here is they captured a woman from the other side. And Sidonio, the hero of the song, went over to just arrange to bring back the woman. It turned out not to be such an easy task.
Hmm. One of the questions that you explore in this book and studying these corridos is something that's very contemporary to probably many forms of music, and that is if you explore violence in a song and sometimes maybe even glorify violence, does that perpetuate more violence?
Yes, you know, it's a very tough question. In fact, when I wrote the book Poetry and Violence, I was wondering if I was somehow contributing to the continuation of violence. And I took comfort in a quote I got from Hannah Arendt, a very nice quote about the most peaceful thing you can do is to try to understand violence. And I thought, okay, that's I can go ahead with this project. But the corrido being focused on violence so often, this has aroused some concern among members of the communities in Mexico. And in fact, quite a few people have stood up and said that corridos should be banned, or people shouldn't really be doing this because it glamorizes the heroes, it glorifies these violent activities. And to be honest with you, there's some truth to that. I wouldn't sit here and say, oh no, the corrido has nothing to do with this problem. It does, because in talking to a lot of the younger men in particular, I found that they did find inspiration in these songs. And that's not to say everybody who hears a song is going to go out and, you know, take up this particular lifestyle. But I think that connection where people do find inspiration in the songs is very real. What I found in my study, though, looking carefully at the lyrics to the songs, but also talking to quite a few people who compose ballads and perform them, I found that there are other things going on as well. And in particular, I found that the corrido also presents a kind of a critique of violence. It asks people to think about violence and what are the consequences of violence. There's quite a few songs that talk about, well, this violent action is going to beget another violent action, and is that really where we want to go? So I think there's a reflective facet to the corrido that hasn't been noticed as much, and I think it's very much part of the tradition. And then, to my surprise, I found that in addition to these things, there's a kind of a healing mission in the corrido, and it's a little bit hard to get at, and people don't talk about it as readily. But what I saw happening was, in the aftermath of one of these disruptive episodes, I found that people would come together around the corrido, and somehow the corrido was part of a way to patch up the community a little bit. So I think that all of these things are happening simultaneously, even though they move in different directions. They're all part of the rich mission of the corrido.
We're talking with John McDowell on this part of Access Utah. And Professor McDowell is chair of the Department of Folklore and Ethnomusicology at Indiana University. And his recent book is the one we've been talking about. It's called Poetry and Violence, the Ballad Tradition of Mexico's Costa Chica. I want to talk a little bit about narco-corridos. This is a subgenre, and some have criticized this as glorifying drug traffickers. And then there are parallels made with gangster rap in the United States, and the same problem we've been talking about. If you glorify people who are violent, glorify violence perhaps, then maybe that perpetuates violence.
Well, that's a great set of issues. I think that the narco corrido thing is big down in the borderlands, let's say from Los Angeles all the way across into the cities of southern Texas. On the other side of the border in the northern states of Mexico, this is a really big phenomenon. I think up here in Utah, and certainly where I'm coming from in Indiana, we don't really get a glimpse of it very often, maybe once in a while through a newspaper article. But down in the L.A. area and in many of those border zones, you've got, you know, monster bands like Los Tigres del Norte and many others who are playing in stadiums with 50,000 people. It's a major phenomenon. It's very troubling. I mean, I think what's happening in Mexico right now is very troubling. And I think the narco corrido, this particular, as you say, it's a subgenre of the same tradition that we've been talking about, the corrido, the ballad of Mexico, is very much in the mix there. In fact, I've been looking into this lately, and I have a project I call the Ballad of Narco Mexico. And the thing that comes out is that people in the drug cartels are actually using corridos to send messages to each other. So there's a level of engagement in the actual give and take of violence here that seems to me a kind of a new feature to the ballad tradition in Mexico. It's a fascinating topic. It's a troubling topic. It's an important one, I think. But certainly, once again, it shows how folklore, how these traditions that are cultivated among the people can be very consequential right in the middle of major world events.
And I guess there's been some talk of banning corridos because of this. I guess that, I don't know how you do that.
Yeah. Well, there's more than talk in across most of Mexico. In fact, I think it's a kind of an agreement. They tried to pass a law in the Mexican Congress that would actually make it illegal to broadcast corridos, narco corridos, on the radios. I believe that bill failed, as far as I know. But nonetheless, the industry reached a kind of a friendly agreement. And as far as I know, throughout Mexico, you will not hear narco corridos on the radio. Now, there may be some exceptions to that. The same is true for many stations in the United States that have a Latino audience. They've also reached kind of a friendly understanding on the basis of the kinds of things we're talking about, that this material is inflammatory, it glorifies people who are basically criminals and so forth. I would come back to the kinds of the complexities that I found in the ballads from down in the interior of Mexico and in the Costa Chica area. I would come back and raise those same questions, and I would look for other things that are happening with the narco corrido. So far, I found my investigations have produced a kind of a mixed message because, for example, on YouTube, there's a tremendous utilization of YouTube to circulate narco corridos, and that material can be pretty one-dimensional in terms of just glorifying the guns, the wealth, the easy money, and so forth. But I think when you look at, for example, the ballads that that Los Tigres are doing and some of the other more mature groups, you'll see that these other factors are in there as well. There is a kind of a reflective stance where, well, let's take a look and see what's happening, what this phenomenon is doing to us as a society. The healing part is a little harder for me to spot at this moment, but I've got my antenna out there, and I'm trying to sort out what's going on.
That's what we would hope for, I would imagine. Let's hear another excerpt. I wonder, Professor, maybe you choose one of those others.
Yeah, I think number one is nice because it's a very traditional ballad, Antonio Vélez.
Let's hear an excerpt from, first of all, tell us a little bit about what we're going to be hearing.
Yeah, Antonio Vélez, this is a corrido about a gentleman who became pretty famous in a region of the coast there down in Mexico, associated with I guess you would call it a gang, although they call them brosa down there. That's the Spanish word for it. It's a gang, but it's more. It has other facets to it, where they sort of look out for the local population in a situation where there isn't really much support from the official authorities. Maybe we could think of it as a gang that's a little bit like a militia. And Antonio Vélez was a leader of one of those groups.
Cantar un corrido no se vayan a enojar la gente de Antonio Vélez no se ha podido arreglar la gente de Antonio Vélez no se ha podido arreglar. Antonio estaba en Quilutla, y tenía gente a su lado.
There's a portion of a corrido called Antonio Vélez. By the way, you can find these at the Indiana University website. Excerpts, are these corridos you found and recorded? How did you come across these?
That's right. So this is a set of corridos that goes along with the book that we've been talking about, Poetry and Violence. I selected 11 corridos for that book to include initially as a CD in the back of the book. Now the book's out in paperback, and you have to go to the publishers, University of Illinois. You have to go to that press and get a hold of the songs there on their website. But these are all songs that I collected with my little, portable tape recorder in the field. Antonio Vélez was in a very interesting place when I first arrived. This is back in that same town of Cruz Grande, I noticed that men were carrying guns around. It was really a time and a place where, you know, things were pretty rough. And so I went straight to what's called the Presidencia Municipal, to the mayor's office, and I met a very friendly fellow there. And then I got to know the mayor a little bit, and he said, "Well, I'm going to send you with some soldiers over to my house, and we'll do some music later on tonight." And so I had a little green Volkswagen Bug then, and we got into the Bug, and these two soldiers get in the back seat with their M1 rifles, and I'm thinking, man, they're going to write a corrido about me the way this is going. But no, it worked out fine. They escorted me over to the mayor's house, and later these musicians came in, and you heard a little sample. Antonio Velez, it starts out like a lot of corridos. It says, "I'm going to sing a corrido." Mm-hmm. So the singer talks right to the public and asks for permission. In this case, he says, "No se vayan a enojar. Please don't be angry," you know, and asking for that kind of dispensation to tell the story. And that's a very typical way for these corridos to begin. But yeah, these are all field-recorded corridos that I found in various out-of-the-way places in Mexico, but also in places like Acapulco, and the tradition does enter into the cities as well.
We're just about out of time. I just wonder why you think this is such an enduring form of expression in Mexico.
Yeah, that's a great question. Very hard to get to the bottom of it. The tradition really can be traced back, believe it or not, to the epics of Spain. So you've got El Cid, which is the famous epic coming from medieval or late medieval times, and a lot of the lines in the corridos are the same. So we're talking about several hundred years of continuity across the ocean. Then the tradition comes to Mexico, and it takes on a Mexican flavor because of indigenous narratives in what became the country of Mexico. It takes on a little different flavor, but it certainly takes root there and continues to be rooted, and now Mexican people carry it up into the United States and up into Canada, always as a kind of a grassroots chronicle of the experience of the people. It's just a magnificent achievement of the Mexican people, and the corrido is known in other parts of Spanish America, but it doesn't have this kind of, presence in the consciousness of the people anywhere else except in Mexico.
And I think you were telling me before we went on the air, there's another subgenre now of immigrant corridos.
Yeah, these are very interesting. Of course, there's the famous line, again, going back to Los Tigres del Norte, who really are in some ways the leaders in a lot of this. They have that great line about, we didn't cross the frontier crossed us, and, you know, referring to the fact that, the historical fact that the southwest of the United States was originally part of Mexico. But there are quite a few groups, and I think in more informal situations, people write ballads describing the migrant experience and the difficulty of what they call indocumentados, people who are in the United States without legal documentation. And you really get it just like with a narco corrido, where you get a different kind of insight into the world of the drug business. With the migrant corridos, you get a very different perspective, and you see it from the experience, the suffering and the difficulty, and the tremendous pain and just rough times that people experience as migrants looking for work in the United States.
And finally, place to go to find corridos. Of course, look up your book, obviously.
Yeah, well, that's a good place to begin. I think that nowadays, if you're looking for anything musical, YouTube is a very good place to go. People have put a lot of resources up there that are historical in nature. And then YouTube has become kind of, they're corridos that are born digital now, that are really created as music videos and are invented to be distributed. At least one of their venues is going to be YouTube. So some of these sites have several hundred thousand hits and so forth. It's really a very legitimate channel of dissemination for the genre today. But there's plenty of research. My teacher, Americo Paredes, has a wonderful book. I recommend it to anybody who wants to get started with thinking about corridos. It's called "With His Pistol in His Hand." With His Pistol in His Hand, which is a line from one of the famous ballads that talks about the problems between Mexicans and Texans down in that contested zone in South Texas. There are a lot of places to go, but there's a few places to get started.
Very good. And by the way, corrido spelled C-O-R-R-I-D-O, if you want to Google that or go to YouTube. John McDowell has been our guest in the first part of the program. He's author of many books. A recent book is Poetry and Violence, the Ballad Tradition of Mexico's Costa Chica. We spent the entire half hour in pleasurable conversation about that, but many other research areas. John McDowell, a pleasure. Thanks for coming in.
It's my pleasure. I always enjoy talking about corridos.
And thanks for listening to Access Utah.
The best laid plans of, well, you know how that saying goes. Now, I know that I had said that I wasn't super excited about Super Sunday and the Super Bowl, that we were instead going to go to the beach. Well, we did go over to the local beach with some friends of ours, and the day started out rather nice. The sun was shining, not a cloud in the sky, and the beach was fairly uncrowded. There were manta rays jumping not far from shore, and we spied four whales doing their thing out in the water, a couple in fairly close, and a huge whale of a whale somewhere out farther by the horizon. This guy was so big that I could see his faraway splash without the aid of binoculars, which we now carry just about everywhere we go because, well, we're rarely far from the water, and you never know what's going to decide to pop in for a visit, whether it's the little rays that think they can fly over the tops of the waves, dolphins engaged in synchronized swimming, or whales breaching. We had taken some friends to Santa Maria Beach the week before, where, less than a mile from shore, a glorious humpback decided it was going to put on a show for us. For a good 20 minutes or so, the whale danced on the water, leaping out and turning graceful arcs midair. It would cruise the surface and roll, a huge flipper extended to the sky. It would dive, showing its flukes before disappearing into the depths. Nobody's quite sure why whales behave this way. Some say it's kind of social behavior. Some say they're just knocking barnacles and parasites off. Others think they're just having fun. Whatever the reason, it is mesmerizing. Now, Sunday's show wasn't quite as spectacular, but any time we spot a whale in the water, it is exciting. Then the clouds started rolling in, and a fairly decent offshore breeze started to blow. It was time to pack our stuff and go. We got home just in time to watch Kelly Clarkson knock it out of the park with her rendition of the national anthem. We watched the Azteca TV broadcast while our computers were dialed into an internet service that broadcasts U.S. networks to those living or visiting abroad. We didn't get the commercials like those of you watching NBC. Mexican TV is not inundated with ads anyway. But we did get to see a pretty good football game, and we thought Madonna rocked the house at halftime. My favorite part, though, was the post-game frenzy when the reporters flooded the field and started shoving microphones in front of the players. It was particularly funny when one of the Azteca field reporters asked Manning a lengthy question in Spanish, then held the microphone in front of him. Manning stood there for a moment, puzzled. Clearly, he had no clue what he had just been asked, but politely, he rattled off a cliche about teamwork, pride, and how much he loves his mom before running off to accept the MVP trophy. So thanks to the whales, Eli Manning, and Madonna, it turned out to be, indeed, a Super Sunday. This is Ed Casilius for Utah Public Radio.
Steve Eaton is a freelance writer who lives in Logan. He writes a column that appears in the Deseret News every other Saturday.
At our house, we all share in the chores. My wife, Barbara, is never expected to do any more than her fair share. Well, sometimes she does more than her fair share, but she can take comfort in knowing that we understand what we call the principle. The principle is that to be a strong and happy family, we must work. When we have time to do so, as a team. I remember a time years ago when Barbara left her supportive team behind and went out of town to go skiing with her parents. She left expecting we would give our all each day to the accomplishment of many small and great chores she detailed out for us in longhand as we drove to the airport. I didn't remember most of the advice she offered, and I lost instructions as soon as I got home. I still remembered a few key things like don't spray Lysol on the plants and always use one kind of laundry detergent on colored bleaches or something like that. Frankly, I didn't need her advice. At the time, I was a professional who worked in a tall building in downtown Seattle. I was someone who knew how to draft strategic plans, create action steps, and hold meetings to accomplish things. I knew that I could come up with a better approach. I created a multicolored Excel spreadsheet that divided up the important household chores. It was a practical plan, and yet one that was beautiful to behold and contemplate. The plan only required us to work for the first few days, and then, unless someone ate something, we'd be done. In fact, I envisioned the family playing miniature golf and going to the movies on school nights before our week was up. Everything went according to plan until we hit the first day. That was when we realized that none of us actually wanted to do our assigned chores that day. This complicated the second day because the first day's chores were undone. On Thursday, I was troubled when I saw some food from Monday making its way across the dining room table on its own power. I realized it was time to take action. So I drafted a mission statement. Our aim is to dialogue and synergize in win-win approaches that will allow us to proactively channel our transforming energies into household outcomes that will help us win pleasure and avoid pain when mom returns. I read the mission statement and sought buy-in from my children. Unfortunately, no one did the dishes. We had to buy clean ones. The day before Barbara was to return, I mobilized my family using new principles learned from the book Management by Threats. Using multiple large and small containers, my daughter, Sarah, and I loaded, organized, and sorted the debris we found spread about the house into the containers. While we worked away in sort of a controlled panic, Jackson, my son, dug holes for the containers in the backyard. We poured apple juice on the kitchen floor in hopes our dog would be more motivated to lick and clean the floor as she had been originally assigned to do on the Excel chart. We purchased air fresheners to add that Martha Stewart touch to our cover-up. I even found the handwritten instructions Barbara wrote and put them on the counter to make it appear that they had been our guiding directives while she was away. It was a foolproof plan, unless Barbara decided to go in the backyard or actually walk across the kitchen floor barefoot. I remember that was the first time Barbara ever grounded me along with the kids. I had to call in and try to explain to my boss why I would be locked in a room with 30 air fresheners for a week. Barbara forced Sarah, who was only 13 at the time, to go to school for a week wearing discolored clothes and carrying a dead plant. Jackson, who was 16 and had never seen the movie Cool Hand Luke, was forced to dig and fill holes in the backyard day and night for 3 days straight. We have a new mission statement now, drafted by Barbara. My husband and children will, from this day henceforth, work their tails off helping me clean the house, or I will proactively set their discolored clothes on fire and spray them with Lysol while they sleep. This is Steve Eaton.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Support for coverage of the Utah Legislature comes from the USU Charter Credit Union, serving members with online bill payer and web teller services for around-the-clock account access. Information is at usuccu.org.
Thanks for staying with us for Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're going to turn to education, public education in Utah, K through 12. Next week, by the way, we'll treat higher education. And we're going to begin this conversation with Senator Aaron Osmond, who represents Salt Lake Area South Jordan, I believe. So where he lives. Senator Osmond, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
I believe you have been talking with a lot of teachers. In fact, there's a post on UtahPublicEducation.org. I want to talk about a few of these things. You call it lessons learned and next steps. First of all, I believe you're going to be running a bill which would make some changes. In fact, it's called Utah's Orderly School Termination Procedures Act. I wonder if you could explain what that is.
Well, actually, the bill has been renamed. It's called the Public Education Employment Reform Act. And what we're focusing on there is really bringing a new and more scrutinized focus on how we manage our human resources within public education, starting first with our administration. You know, when you look at leadership throughout public education, we have pockets of great leadership and innovation and other areas where we're struggling. And we feel that in order to bring real change into public education, we have to start at the top. We have to look at what is the quality of our administration, what kind of leadership are they really providing relative to the quality of instruction in our schools, how are they managing their employees and holding them accountable for the quality of their work that they do within our schools. So we're starting first on increasing the accountability of our administration throughout the state by having and introducing regular annual evaluations of their performance, tying that performance back specifically to their leadership and how they're managing their staff. That's step one of this bill.
So are we talking about superintendents, principals? Who are we talking about here?
Actually, we're talking about both. We're talking about district leadership and we're talking about school leadership. And really asking the state now to take on a role of regularly evaluating how that leadership is performing. How are they leading out in their schools and improving the quality of instruction? How are they leading out in fulfilling their responsibility to evaluate and review every employee within their schools? What are they doing to really solve performance problems of employees? Are they actively doing the job that we expect them to do as leaders? And what I discovered as I traveled throughout the state over the last couple of months is we have great administration, but we're really not looking carefully. We're not measuring carefully their performance. Most of administrators only have an evaluation once every 3 years or so. And I'm saying, let's have a regular evaluation. We will get what we inspect. And if we're inspecting the quality of leadership of our administrators at both the district and the school level for the role that we expect them to do, we will see increased performance as we do in any organization.
What is the enforcement, the teeth, you might call it? A bad evaluation could get you fired?
Well, that could happen, but we're also tying under this bill that a component of their total compensation will be converted to performance pay. So over the period of time, as they receive increases in pay through merit or cost of living increases or performance increases, we will convert that salary to performance pay until over a period of years, a minimum of 15% of an administrator's total compensation will be tied to performance pay that is directly tied back to their annual evaluations. So there will be an incentive to perform financially for administration. I think that's the one place where you can really tie performance pay to an individual within public education. So that's a key component of the bill. And I wanted to point out a couple other important pieces of this bill for you as well. We're going to be looking at ways to improve the process of our evaluations for our teachers and other public education employees as well. One of the things we're doing is clearly defining the importance of remediation and identifying when there is a performance problem, let's act on it. Let's try to correct it and do it in a timely fashion. We're going to be putting a window of 120 school days on any performance of remediation effort, saying to administration, look, once you've identified there's a performance problem, then act on it. You have 120 days to remediate that employee and work with that employee to solve the problem or make the decision to terminate or remove that employee. And by putting that pressure on administration to do it, we significantly increase, we believe, the effectiveness of an administrator to get the job done.
So this targets leadership this time around. Will these principles be applied at a later time, maybe next legislative session or later in this session, to teachers?
Yes, we're also going to be working on some what I think will be some innovative legislation relative to collaborative performance pay. We're running another bill called collaborative performance bonuses that will allow us to be able to recognize and reward the way that teachers work together achieving academic outcomes within schools. So we're going to say, look, you know, as a school, you're going to be receiving school grades. So depending on the performance of those school grades, you'll receive certain bonus amounts that will be distributed to teachers based on the achievement of that school grade, and your individual performance will also be considered in that as far as distribution. But we went out and we heard the teachers loud and clear throughout the state. They want to be recognized for the collaborative work that they do and rewarded for that. We believe that if we create incentives for academic outcomes at a school level, recognizing that collaborative effort, that it will improve it.
Do you have teacher buy-in on this, including formal buy-in, UEA?
Yeah, in fact, one of the great things about these bills is that we've been working collaboratively with the Utah Education Association, the Utah School Boards Association, the State Board of Education. This has been an ongoing, collaborative, joint process to develop legislation that we can all buy into, requiring negotiation and compromise on all sides to really achieve the outcomes that we want. It's been a very positive effort. Many of that have been involved in this bill conversation have said that it's been a unique and positive change in the relationship and the sentiment between the stakeholders in public education and the legislature.
I hear objections sometimes to these sorts of plans, very logical, but some teachers say if we're maybe spending too much time looking at these performance issues, we'd just rather teach. And good teachers are good teachers, and bad teachers are bad teachers.
I definitely agree that we have spent a lot of time trying to find a way to be able to evaluate performance. And one of the great things that have come out of the legislature this session is this focus on adaptive testing technology and the capacity to very quickly and easily assess, even prescriptively assess, the gaps in education, both with students and the gaps within classes for teachers where there is weakness. And I think that these types of technologies will help us quickly determine that we're performing or not performing and why, and allow us to address and remediate those problems rather than finding ways to punish teachers or identifying why teachers are the problem in our system. It's not about the teachers from my perspective. It starts first with leadership, then appropriate utilization of technology, and then enabling our teachers to focus on teaching with what they do best.
One of the lessons learned, you have several lessons learned from all of these meetings. You say we have a morale problem among our public education employees. How do we address that?
Yes. Well, I think the way that we address it is through working together and really trying to understand the problems that are in the classroom. In the last 45 days, for example, I spent nearly 40 hours personally just sitting in a classroom and observing student-to-teacher interaction and spending time with teachers, not in just large meeting settings, but really in their classrooms, hearing what they're dealing with, seeing what they're dealing with. As we reach out to education and the education stakeholders and let them know that we're really interested in understanding what they're facing and then work together with them on solutions, they're the experts in public education. They know what they're dealing with. And by the way, they want to change too. They're willing to change as long as they feel like their voice is heard and that they have a say in the outcomes. We can achieve great reformation in public education to the benefit of our kids. That's what they're asking for, and I think that's the steps that we're making right now.
One of your other lessons learned, classroom sizes are an issue. I didn't look up your vote. Did you vote for Senator Morgan's bill, which would mandate reduction?
I did. I feel that classroom size is an important dialogue. We are already spending over $100 million on trying to reduce classroom size, and what's great about this bill is that we now have some accountability. We're putting some caps and saying, you know what? Both the state and the districts need to take this seriously. And we need to start where it's going to have the most impact first, and that's in grades K through 3. So I felt very strongly that we needed to support this both for accountability reasons and to send a message to our friends and to all those who are working so hard in public education that we need to make a real statement that class size does make a difference when it comes to individual attention with students, which affects education outcomes.
Finally, you say one of the other lessons learned, the lack of clear and unified vision for education. The teachers get competing messages. What should that clear and unified vision be?
Well, a couple of days ago, we passed through the Senate Education Committee an agreement that we needed to have a clear mission and vision statement. We elected to adopt, at least through committee so far, the mission and vision statement that has been set up by our constitutional partner, the State Board of Education. And that vision is very clearly articulated within this language. And I think it will be powerful if we can use that legislation, that statement, to guide our legislative efforts, that it will help clarify for everyone involved in public education what the legislature and the State Board of Education are trying to do. And I would encourage anyone that's interested in that to study that bill. You can find that information off the legislative website.
Very good, Senator Aaron Osmond. We're talking about education, K through 12. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
And following a brief break, we'll be back with Senator Karen Morgan. We'll continue our discussion on education at the legislature following this.
Support for legislative coverage comes from USU's Department of Political Science, committed to improving the community, the state, the nation, and beyond, and supporting UPR's coverage of the Utah legislature. Information is at politicalscience.usu.edu.
And we continue our discussion of K through 12 education at the legislature with Senator Karen Morgan. Senator, thanks for joining us.
Oh, of course.
We finished our discussion with Senator Osmond with the big picture. What should the vision for education? One of the problems he found, he says, talking to teachers, the lack of clear and unified vision for education. I wonder what your unified vision for the grand vision for education should be.
Oh, well, I believe the grand vision is that we provide the very best education for our children that we possibly can. And we actually have had a Best Schools initiative, and several pieces of legislation are fitting into that. We believe that every child deserves a top-quality education. And as part of our Best Schools initiative, we believe that, every child deserves a great teacher and more individualized attention, a world-class curriculum, and then neighborhood support in our neighborhood schools, community involvement. We believe that, communities can help to make their schools the very, very best in the nation.
Of course, this takes money, and I know the Democrats have proposed blocking out certain sums of money over several years to improve education. Some Republicans say that's good in principle, but we can't block out those things in the future. We have to wait and see what the budget is. I wonder if your response to that.
Well, we can certainly block out certain amount. I mean, we have an education fund. Income taxes go into that education fund. And, we've been struggling the last few years with our economy and not enough money coming into that fund. But the good news is we've turned the corner, and we do have more dollars, and we have money in that fund now where we can fund growth, enrollment growth. We have over 12,000 new students who will be coming into the system this fall, and we need to take care of them and make sure that, they have the funding. And then there's enough money in that education fund, that's come in that we can take care of some other needs, and such as class size reduction and, just some other things that need to be met, increases to the value of WPU. There are a variety of proposals for those dollars, but all of those will go to enhance our public education system.
Your bill mandating a reduction in class sizes for the lower grades, Senate Bill 31, has passed. The Senate moves on to the House. I wonder if you could explain in brief what this does.
Yes. This bill puts a cap on class sizes in kindergarten through grade 3. It limits kindergarten classes to 20, first and second grade classes to 22, and third grade classes to 24. And, 36 other states have already enacted caps, K through 3, and many of them have enacted class size caps in all of elementary school and even in middle and high school. So this is not anything unusual. And, we just have the largest class sizes in the nation. Our pupil-teacher ratio is 1 to 27, and that becomes crowd control. I mean, it's really hard for children to receive the individualized attention that they need. And especially in those early grades, those are foundational years for children. Those are the years when they're learning the very basics of reading and math. And if they don't have those basic skills set by the time they leave third grade, data shows that they have a very, very hard time catching up. So if we can get that more individualized attention in those early grades, it'll help with children's future success.
Opponents of your bill say that while the goal is laudable, it can be very expensive to lower class sizes, and some districts may be forced to take from other programs to reach this goal.
Well, no, that is not true, because we have a fiscal analyst who analyzes the entire education budget, and he actually did not even put a fiscal note on this. Originally, the fiscal note was $12.8 million, but after they got to examining this and looking at language in the bill that allow that is actually accountability for a line item that we have in our budget currently, where we provide $103 million every year to the districts to lower class sizes, and there has never been any accountability back for that. Also, my bill allows districts and schools, if they can't meet that cap, you know, we understand that maybe they can't build a new building, or, you know, maybe they don't have classroom space for another class. So our bill allows the flexibility for them to hire a paraprofessional or a teacher's aide to be in the classroom full-time with that teacher. So that's another way around it. And so technically it's a soft cap rather than a hard cap. And, yeah, there's a lot of flexibility in the bill. But the end result is that, you know, the children will receive more individualized attention and there will be accountability for the line item in our budget, that $103 million that's already going out to the district. That's what actually will fund this.
As you know, Utah is, I believe, we're last in per pupils of spending, have been so for quite a while. Will there be enough budget surplus in the budget to start to get out of the basement there?
Well, we need to start to get out of the basement, but there's a very large gap between us and the next lowest. So, you know, we would have to put a lot of money into our public schools to even become next to last. And, you know, it's something that we need to work towards, though. And, it's a pretty sad situation. We're the lowest, but we're by far the lowest. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're way below the second lowest. Yeah. So.
Of course, some say that we shouldn't really be looking at that so much as the factor, because Utah does a great job with the small amount of money that we do have.
Well, we do a great job, but in comparison to other states with the very same demographics, that we have, we are lagging behind them as well. It's not only, you know, we're not only lagging behind, you know, other states in the nation that have a lot more, but we're lagging behind other states with the very same demographics. So, you know, it's a serious issue, but we need to be creative in how we address our needs.
And just briefly, just have about a minute left. Republicans often bring up the performance and initiatives for performance of teachers, accountability. We just talked to Senator Osmond, who's running a bill that would talk about the performance of leaders, superintendents, and principals. Do you support that bill?
Yes, I do. I do. I think that we need to be examining the performance of our administrators. After all, they are the ones who oversee the entire system, whether it's the superintendents overseeing their districts or whether it's principals overseeing their individual schools and their teachers. I mean, it all comes back to the administration and how they run their programs, how they run their schools, yes.
Well, we'll be keeping an eye, of course, on this and many other issues. K-12 education has been our subject, and we'll keep an eye specifically on Senate Bill 31, Senator Karen Morgan's bill. It's passed the Senate and now heads to the House. It would mandate reduction in class sizes for the lower grades. Senator Morgan, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for the opportunity. Have a great day.
You too. And it's Science Questions with Sherry Quinn. That's tomorrow on Access Utah. That's 9 to 10 tomorrow. Join us then. Access Utah Today. Thanks for listening.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.
Support for Utah Public Radio comes from S.E. Needham Jewelers in historic downtown Logan since 1896, specializing in diamond engagement rings and custom jewelry design, middle of the block at the sign of the clock. Information at seneedham.com.